This is Digital Story Podcast number 976, December 3rd, 2024. Today's theme is making the case for using GPS with travel photography. I'm Derek Story. One thing that surprised me this past year when talking to workshop photographers was how few of them were adding location data to their images during capture. I can understand not doing so while taking pictures around the house, but during travel? On this week's podcast, I present my case for making the extra effort. I hope you enjoy the show. One of the great things about our smartphones is that they record GPS data with every photo we take. Those coordinates are translated into actual locations by the software we use to manage our pictures, such as Apple Photos, Adobe Lightroom, and Capture One Pro. This information, combined with the camera's normal XF data, informs us of just about everything we need to know about the image we're looking at. Not only do we get the camera settings used, but we can also see the time of day, map location, and with some units, altitude and direction. Now the problem is, we don't use our smartphones exclusively for our photography. Well, at least many of us don't, right? So we have what we call our regular cameras. And that could be anything from a DSLR to your mirrorless camera, point and shoot, anything that is outside of your smartphone itself. And most of these cameras, there are some notable exceptions, but most of these cameras do not automatically record location data the same way that our smartphones do. The nice thing about this information, when you have it, is that it's searchable by practically any image manager software. So without having to do anything more than press a shutter button, we can record a mountain of information with the picture itself. This is a luxury that film photographers could only dream about a decade or so ago. So unless we want to shoot everything with our smartphones, we probably aren't getting that location data that is so useful, as I'm going to talk about and try to persuade you in this podcast, that is so useful with every picture that we take. Now, let's take a look at some of the different ways that we can get this information associated with our pictures. I'll start with my Pentax KP, my DSLR. It has an optional GPS-1 unit. It goes in the hot shoe. And the data readout from this unit includes location, direction, time of shooting using universal time coordinated. It also features an electronic compass to display the direction the camera is facing, and that's true direction after declination adjustment. And all of this happens on the LCD monitor. This information is also useful for shooting preparation. So I know if I know a direction I have to be facing at a certain time, then the digital compass can help me do that. That is an external unit that plugs into the camera or slides into its hot shoe and then communicates with the camera via the contacts in the hot shoe. Another camera that I have and that I record location data with is the Olympus TG4. And as you guys know from listening to this podcast, I'm still using an older model of it, but you know what? It works great. It does. With that built-in unit, I can access the readout screen just by hitting the info button twice on the TG4, and then everything shows up on the LCD. And that's data for latitude, for longitude, barometer, altitude or water depth, and a real-time digital compass also that shows which direction the camera is pointing, all built into the camera itself. So I don't have to do anything with that particular camera to get that information. It just happens. The GPS radio is built into the camera, and off to the races we go. This is, of course, by far the easiest solution. Now, both cameras, even though they use different methods, they write this information to the XF data that is associated with each picture. So where you have things like shutter speed and f-stop and ISO, all that good stuff, if you have one of these units actively talking to your camera, then you also have latitude, longitude, and all that good stuff right in there. It's all right in there. When I scan pictures from my Fujifilm X100V in the Photos app, the bulk of those images have location data attached as well. And that's because when I get out of the car, I turn on the Fujifilm X app on my iPhone. The X100V is already paired with the app, so they immediately search for each other. Within a minute, they are communicating via Bluetooth, and the iPhone is sending GPS coordinates from its radio to the X100V, which in turn embeds that information with each picture I take. It's just become a habit for me, especially when I'm traveling with the Fujifilm, to get out of the car, launch the app, and then after I launch the app on the iPhone, I can just put the iPhone in my pocket or whatever. It doesn't have to stay on. I don't have to hold the iPhone out or anything like that. Just put it back in my pocket, and then they're talking to each other. And one of the reasons why this works so well, this case of the smartphone talking to the camera, is that the later versions of Bluetooth that we have access now, they're great. They're really good at, you know, keeping the connection. They're good at being efficient in terms of their energy use. They're just really terrific. It is not, you know, back in the Bluetooth 2.0 days, you know, now we're at Bluetooth 5 something. And that has really made this whole process of smartphone talking to camera a lot better. With these different cameras, you know, I have touched on the different scenarios that we have available to us for making sure that you have location information associated with your pictures. So just to sum those up, you have GPS built into the camera, and that's the case of the TG4 and the iPhone. Both of those draw power to run that GPS radio. They draw power from the camera's battery itself. Okay, so that's something to note. Then there are external GPS units, and they usually slide into the hot shoe of our camera. The Pentax GPS-1 is one of those. And then it uses the contacts in the hot shoe to communicate with the camera. Now, it's powered by its own AAA battery. So that's one advantage. A disadvantage, of course, is that you have this little knob sitting on top of your camera. So obviously, as I mentioned at the top of the show, you know, GPS logging isn't something that I'm going to do all the time, not when I'm banging around the house, probably not even when I go out for a walk, you know, in the afternoon at work. I'm probably not going to worry about GPS data. But if I find myself somewhere like, let's say Costa Rica in January, I'm definitely going to have that on. It'd be really nice to have all of that logged with all the pictures so that when I go back and look at the pictures, I can say, you know, this jungle and this jungle look a lot alike, but this one's actually, you know, 40 miles from this one. And that's where this one is, and that's where this one is, right? That kind of thing. The external GPS units are really nice in the sense that they're not going to drain your camera battery, but, you know, you do have an extra device to keep track of. And then there's the camera paired with the smartphone via the app. And really the biggest downside to this is what kind of app you have to work with. Like, I have noticed from camera brand to camera brand, there's a big difference. I mean, my easiest one of the camera brands that I work with is the Fujifilm X app. It, to me, just is the easiest to work with. Once I turn it on, and the camera's on, and they're talking to each other, I really don't have to think about it, and it just does its thing. But I still struggle with the Olympus app, OiShare, for doing this. It's hit or miss a lot of times with that. I've had hit or miss with the Nikon SnapBridge app. Sometimes it works really well. Sometimes I just do something a little wrong or different or something. I don't know. And it doesn't work as well. So, I mean, it really does vary from app to app. And this is why it's really worth testing to see what you have. You have the stuff right now to do this. It just depends on, you know, which gear you have and how easy it is to use. The last way, and this is my least favorite way, but you can add this information in post-production, right? There's a couple ways you can do it. You can run a geo tracker on your phone or whatever that creates a data file that you sync with the pictures in the app afterwards. Or you can add location data to photos in software. You can even do this in Apple Photos. You can drop a pin or whatever and add location data that way. Personally, I don't like any of those methods. I don't like extra work. I'm trying to stay away from extra work with my photography and just enjoy, you know, the imagery itself. So I'm not a fan of any of those, but it is an option. And some people don't mind that extra work, and so that's available to them as well. So those are the four basic ways you can get that location data with your pictures. Now, for those of you who don't like keywording, and I'm going to be the first to admit that I am in this group, I have some good news for you. The combination of improved object recognition in our photo software, where you can now just type in beach ball, and the software will pull up all the pictures that have a beach ball in them, that kind of thing. So that's improved hand over fist many times over now. And we have decent object recognition in many of our photo software apps. You combine that with the location data, this is pretty powerful. Not only can you type in Marina Sunset and get that beautiful sunset shot that you were thinking about with the boats silhouetted and all that good stuff, then if it has location data as well, you actually know which marina it is. And you never had to enter a keyword for any of that. The object recognition found the photo, and then your XF data provides all the additional information. Pretty cool stuff. I mean, this is a winning combination, and it just makes it easier and easier for me not to feel guilty about not keywording. There are a few downsides to this. Of course, there always are. Our cameras don't utilize the super accurate military GPS functionality. Too bad, but I understand why they don't. Honestly, the location isn't always precise, so you have to sort of take that with a grain of salt. Plus, I have had the instance where the unit didn't update when I changed locations, and I never really sure why that happens, but I have had it happen. So that can lead to some inaccuracy as well. One thing I try to remember when I change locations is that I can recalibrate the unit, and that means basically waving it around the camera or whatever it is, just in a figure eight, sort of in a figure eight motion for a few seconds. And that seems to recalibrate it. And then I get a lot more accurate information after I've done that. So I try to remember when I'm out in the field, and if it's important that I have the best GPS data possible, that when I change locations, I do that recalibration for a second. And it's usually like when I'm looking around, it's just sort of this mindless thing. You know, I'm kind of looking around, looking for the shots and stuff, waving my camera in a figure eight. I'm sure it's a sight to behold by people if they're watching me do my thing out there. Then there's battery life, of course, right? So, you know, this radio, this GPS radio, does draw power. If it's drawing from your camera and or your smartphone, then over the course of the day, you will notice it. You will notice it. It's not a big drain, but if you have a shoot, and this happens often when we're traveling, you're out taking pictures, you know, for hours, whole afternoon, sometimes a whole day, you're out there taking pictures. So this is a case where you may notice that you need to change batteries a little faster than if you're not using it. And so you need to keep that in mind and make sure that you have you know, the energy that you need in order to keep doing this. So it does draw power. Nothing in this universe seems to be free. There's always some sort of price for that. But the bottom line is that embedded location information is not only useful for our own memory of pictures we captured, but it's also helpful for those who view our images in the future after we're gone. So where was Dad and Mom when this great shot was taken, right? Well, hopefully, you know, it'll have that location information right there in the metadata, and they can see that it was Santa Monica, you know, in 1989 or something like that. I don't know. I'm just pulling these things out of midair, but you get what I'm saying. Not only having the date embedded, but the location embedded, that can be pretty darn helpful, you know, when you're looking at historical shots. So I love that aspect of it. Also, if you're recording changes in our environment, say you're going back to a location over and over again, let's say that every 5 years you go up to Alaska and you're photographing the Mendenhall Glacier, and you want to know the location from which you photographed it, and or you want to return to that location, well, GPS data can help you, can aid with that kind of work as well. As I said earlier, you may have everything you need right now to get started with GPS recording. It could be just a matter of getting your devices paired. But when you travel, I think it's really worth it. And, you know, I'd like you to consider it. Now, practice before you go, just like we do with everything else. And then on your next trip, go ahead and record the data and see what you think. I just love having it. And I'm surprised more photographers don't do it. Maybe a few more will do it after listening to this podcast. The Sony A1-2 sensor is almost 4 years old. Here's why that doesn't matter. And this is an article that's on Digital Camera World, and I have a link to it in the show notes. The new Sony A1 Mark II is making headlines for its incredible speed and AI-driven subject recognition. There's no doubt it's an incredible flagship camera. But there's one thing Sony is a little less keen to promote. It's 50.1 megapixel stacked CMOS sensor that has been directly carried over from the original A1, a camera now almost 4 years old. Reusing a sensor in this way is nothing new, though. There have been plenty of DSLR and mirrorless cameras that have inherited the sensor from the preceding model. But what I think makes the A1-2 sensor recycling more noteworthy is that this is a flagship camera with a price tag that's high even by flagship standards. There are plenty of reasons why Sony may have chosen to retain the original A1 sensor. For starters, it's a darn good sensor. It's incredible that any sensor is able to maintain a high enough readout speed to facilitate 30 frames per second continuous shooting at 50 megapixels. And it's arguable whether we actually need a sensor more potent than that right now. Some may resent that the A1-2 lacks a global shutter, given this is already present in a slightly older and significantly cheaper A9 Mark III. The general manager of Sony's Lens Technology and Systems Division has answered this criticism along with a general critique of the A1-2's sensor that isn't new. Here's what he has to say. The sensor used in the A1 has a fast readout comparable to a global shutter and has very little image distortion. It was a sensor with high potential to begin with. This time, we improved the image processing algorithm to improve image quality. The A1-2 has evolved to be worthy of a new flagship camera. And here we have the core reason why the A1-2 sensor wasn't changed. We improved the image processing algorithm to improve image quality. It's long been the case in the camera phone world that the physical image sensor doesn't necessarily impact image quality at the extent that people would assume. The Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra, for instance, uses the same 200 megapixel primary image sensor that was in the S23 Ultra. Google is the master of recycling image sensors, though it used the same sensor in the Pixel's primary camera for 4 consecutive phone generations. And yet, despite this hardware stagnation, the image quality in the subsequent Pixel generations still noticeably improved, all thanks to the constantly evolving image processing. This is what we see in the case of the A12. Sony has not only tweaked and improved the image processing for the A1 Mark II, it has also harnessed the power of AI, so you get more reliable autofocus and an improved hit rate. Given that the A1 Mark II is priced exactly the same as the original A1, I don't think that reused image sensor is anything close to a deal breaker, especially when it's still so capable and when you consider many other aspects of the new camera have been improved. And this article really caught my eye because of the conversation we had last week about planned obsolescence and how I think there's a certain immunity to that in the world of photography. And a big part of it is that we don't need to constantly be improving the hardware in order to get better pictures out of these devices. And we just had a couple really good examples in this article. If you have a solid sensor, if you have a great lens, and then you improve the software that powers that, you can get better image quality using hardware that, you know, has already been developed and that's already in stock. Now, this just makes business sense on so many reasons. It makes good environmental sense. It just makes sense all the way around. But yet, sometimes we get hung up on, well, this is a brand new camera, but yet it's using the same sensor from a previous generation or even 2 previous generations ago. I don't feel good about that. Well, there's no reason. If the final output is improved, then it doesn't really make any difference why. That's their job. That's what they do. They look at the hardware, they look at the software, they look at the lens, and they look at what they can do, and they try really, honestly, to put the best product forward. So I thought that this article fit in well with this whole idea of photography's ability to withstand planned obsolescence. It really isn't there, or it doesn't have to be there. And this is kind of neat. I think it's kind of neat that Sony is able to come out with a new model, make these improvements, and then still leverage the same sensor from the previous model. I think it's cool myself. Editing portraits start to finish in Lightroom on an iPad. And the link to the video and the notes about it are on fstoppers.com, and I have that link in the show notes. Now, this is mainly a video, but I'll read you a little bit of the text with it. This is something that I'm very interested in. Obviously, I talked about the new iPad mini and its capabilities that I've been testing. And of course, next year, one of our online workshops is going to be about mobile photography, integrating our smartphone and our regular cameras, and with tablets and computers, and you know how this all mashes up so well these days. Let me read you what they say here real quick. The ability to edit portraits entirely in Lightroom without switching to Photoshop is becoming more common. This is especially true for on-the-go editing on devices like the iPad, which sync seamlessly with Lightroom on the desktop. This insightful video showcases the process of retouching a portrait from start to finish using Lightroom on an iPad. The photographer begins with selecting a camera profile, emphasizing how profiles like camera matching portrait can enhance shadow details. The step offers a foundation for the edit, but it's worth noting that this folder only appears if your camera is supporting. Adjusting the white balance with the eyedropper tool further neutralizes unwanted color cast, particularly handy if the image includes neutral tones like a gray in the background. And then the video goes on and talks about tonal adjustments. He uses some of the AI tools that Lightroom offers it's just really cool. I took a look at it. It's about a 20-minute video, and it's terrific, and I think it's instructive. And if you're curious about, you know, how far you can go with an iPad and image editing, maybe thinking about leaving the laptop behind on your next trip while you're recording GPS data with your camera, then you might want to take a look at this article. One last little tidbit here. Kodak temporarily pauses all film production. A little bit of a misleading headline, but the article is good. And this is on petapixel.com. Eastman Kodak has temporarily ceased all film production at its Rochester, New York factory as the company seeks to modernize its facility. Yes, see, this is a good thing. This is a good story. During a Q3 2024 earnings call on November 13th, Eastman Kodak CEO revealed that the move is so the company is better equipped to deal with the increased demand for film. Quote, "We're doing a shutdown in November, total shutdown." He said on the call, "We've continued to invest in our manufacturing process. While we need to shut down completely to bring light into dark, right? Film is made in the dark." He also notes that increased production in recent months, so the shutdown doesn't affect stock. Quote, "In November, we will be modernizing the plant, putting more investment within that, which also caused us to use more cash in the quarter to build up inventories while we do this. But as we continue to see our commitment to our customers' commitment to film, still, and motion picture, we are going to continue to invest in that space and continue with that growth." So this is cool. I mean, I love hearing about this renewed investment by Kodak in film production. And we have some other good manufacturers also producing good film stock. You know, the nice thing about it is that when they see a business reason to do this, that's just a good sign all the way around. I know a lot of you out there still enjoy shooting film, and it's wonderful to be able to have a nice selection of film or your favorite emulsions available to you. And it looks like Kodak is keeping its eye on the ball in this area. I have a workshop note. We have an opening for our Costa Rica workshop that's coming up on January 7 through 15. We had a late cancellation on that workshop, and so a space has opened up. I haven't been able to talk about this workshop much because it sold out so quickly that, you know, it would be, well, just mean, right, to talk about a workshop that's already sold out. But we do have a space open now. And in the show notes, I have a link to the workshop page, which is extensive. It really goes into all the details about this January 7 through 15 workshop, limiting the group to 10 people. And it's co-led by both myself and Rob Knight. And we have everything lined up for this. We've lined up guides. We have transportation. We have accommodations. We have meals. All you have to do is pack your bag and get a flight. And come out and join us. So anyway, the space is open, first come, first served basis. The link's in the show notes. If you wanted to go to Costa Rica, or if you want to go to Costa Rica, you want to go with a great group of photographers, and you want to go with two instructors that I think are wonderful to hang out with, this is an excellent opportunity. Okay, it's the Care of a Little Virtual Camera Club News. I want to start out by thanking our Inner Circle members, the folks that support this podcast month in and month out. They also receive discounts to all of our workshops, including Costa Rica. Yeah, baby. And they also have their own space, their Inner Circle space on Derek Story Online. If you're interested in becoming an Inner Circle member, all you have to do is click on the Patreon tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story. You can sign up there, and then all of your benefits are immediately available to you. And a big thanks to our Inner Circle members for their support. I'd like to give a shout out to our friends at Red River Paper, longest running sponsor of the Digital Story. It's still not too late to stock up on paper for holiday printing, for gifts, for family members, for friends, for fine art cards, for anything creative that you have in mind that involves an inkjet printer and paper to print it on. There are also lots of ideas on the Red River Paper site, and they will help you choose the right paper for what you want to do. All sorts of information waiting for you there. And of course, the best selection at a wonderful price is also waiting for you at Red River Paper. And you get free shipping using our discount. Make sure you click on the tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story. You'll see the discount code on our landing page. Nose around a bit, get some paper, and make some beautiful artwork for the holidays. And a big thanks to Red River Paper for supporting this podcast. All right, it's going to do it for me this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Working on more great stuff for next week. Until then, get out there, take some pictures, stay safe. See you next Tuesday. Bye-bye now.